removed from your business for 4 consecutive weeks and seeing how the business does. Now, people are terrified to do this because they haven't prepared the business. And what I argue in the book is it's not a question if you're going to take a 4-week vacation. It's simply a question of when you're going to take a 4-week vacation, maybe thrust upon you through illness or some kind of unexpected situation that you have to address, but it is going to happen. You're not going to be there forever for every day.
Welcome to the Become a Writer Today podcast with Brian Collins. Here you'll find practical advice and interviews for all kinds of writers.
Have you ever considered taking one of your old books and rewriting it? Hi there, my name is Brian Collins. Welcome to the Become a Writer Today podcast. Writing a book is a big endeavor. It can take months to come up with a first draft, to edit it, and then to turn it into something that you're happy to send to an editor for feedback. And then when you get feedback, you're probably going to spend a bit more time fixing your book. And that's to say nothing of sending a book to beta readers who may have additional queries and clarifications for you. So all in all, by the time you've written your book, if you're anything like me, chances are you are happy that it's done and you're ready to move on. But what if a time comes when you're a year or two into having published a book and the ideas in the book have changed, there are new concepts that you've discovered, and you just simply have more information and research that you'd like to include, or perhaps simply better stories which could help your readers, particularly if it's non-fiction? Several years ago, I invited Mike McAlwitz onto the Become a Writer Today podcast. His non-fiction business books are fantastic. I particularly got a lot of help out of Clockwork and his other book, Profit First. Profit First is all about how to organize finances in a small business. And Clockwork is all about how to accomplish more without necessarily burning yourself out. It also covers other topics like identifying your core competencies, a concept that Mike describes as the Queen Bee role, and how to protect this role in your business through the help of other team members. Well, Mike spent a lot of time working with the ideas inside of this book and teaching them to students and also delivering them through public speaking. And over the years, he realized that there were some ideas that he wanted to retell and reshare in a different way. So he set out to rewrite Clockwork, and he's recently published a new edition. So Mike's come back on the show to explain how the rewriting process went, and he has a number of practical tips which can help you if you're considering rewriting one of your older non-fiction books. He also talks about how his thinking about outsourcing and about identifying your core competencies has changed. And he talks about what his core competency is as a nonfiction business author. Hope you enjoyed this week's interview with Mike. It was great to catch up with Mike again. And one of my key takeaways from talking to him is how he's clarified what his core strength is and how he's worked on that over the years to build up a business that enables him to write even more and get paid well for doing it, and also to help his readers and students and his clients. So if you found this week's interview with Mike McAlwitz helpful or enjoyable, please leave a short review on the iTunes store or hit the star button, because your reviews and ratings help more listeners find the Become a Writer Today podcast, which will in turn help it grow. So it really does mean a lot. You can also share the show with another writer or another friend by using Spotify, by using Overcast, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this week's podcast episode. And of course, if you do have feedback, I'm also on Twitter at Brian, B-R-Y-A-N-J Collins. And please reach out to me if you have guest suggestions or if you have feedback about my interview with Mike. Welcome back, Mike.
Brian, it's a pleasure to be back with you.
I interviewed you pretty soon after I launched the Become a Writer Today podcast about your first, one of your earlier books, Profit First, which was a fantastic read. And at the time you had just written Clockwork, which was published, I think, 2018. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. That's about 4 years ago. Yeah.
And what have you been up to over the past 4 years?
Well, writing books. So since that version of Clockwork, I've released a couple more books, Fix This Next and Get Different, and then a children's book, but also spent a lot of time reinvestigating Clockwork. It's my second most popular book next to Profit First. And we started a division, a company that supports it. And we had our 1,000th student take the class. And we learned through that person and the 999 before them a lot of things that could be improved in the book, a lot of points of confusion or complexity. And I endeavored to fix it in this new release.
Had you also learned from speaking about the book in public about what to change or what to improve?
Yeah. You know, speaking in public is so powerful because you can just see by the audience's energy or by a raise of hands where they're confused or where they're engaged, where they feel empowered and not. So yeah, I've been actively speaking on Clockwork regularly. And I do that before I write even the first book. I'm actively speaking on it to really hone it in. So the process I follow is first figure out what the problem is. Then once I understand the problem, generate hypotheses on how to fix it, then test it. I am fortunate to be a shareholder in multiple small businesses, so we deploy it in our own companies and then try it with other businesses, then set up courses for people to do it, then write the book and continue to speak. And it's during that continued speaking that there's still some tweaks I discover. When I really release a book now, I realize it's never perfect. And some of them could be improved so significantly by simplifying things that the impact would be much greater. Profit First is a second release, the version that's popular now, and Clockwork now has gone through that same revision. And yeah, public speaking is a big part of it.
How do you find the rewriting process? Because I would imagine when you feel like a book is done, it can be a little bit difficult to go back and find out that it's not done, that there are some new things that have to be said.
I remember one author saying, once I write a book, I'm never going to read a single review of that book because I'm never going to write it again. And my philosophy is some of my books, I think, are adequate as they are. But I think there's other ones that just, there's certain parts that only time will reveal how it can be improved because the work environment's changing or the principles didn't play out on the mass scale as it did on the micro scale. So the rewrite for me is reevaluating every element of the book of Clockwork and saying, does this work? And if so, to what degree? So some work, like there's one big concept called the QBR, the Queen Bee Role. It worked. The thing was, people were struggling to figure out their own QBR. I remember one person called, QBR stands for the most critical, it's the Queen Bee Role, it's the most critical function of the business that you stake your company's reputation on. Meaning what you're known for, what's the activity that delivers on that promise? I remember one person saying, the most critical activity in my business is invoicing. Because if we don't invoice, we're never going to get money. So invoicing is everything to my company that should never be compromised. And my response to that person was, well, if you go to your clients and say, what's the most important thing we do? Is it invoicing? What are they going to say? And he's like, no, they care about our service and the fact that we're so timely. So my argument back then was, well, it's the timeliness of your service that you're staking your reputation on. What's the activities that support that? That's the heart of your organization. So I had to restructure that. And so I went through the whole book. It's 60% brand new content, new case studies, original framework concepts reinvented, and 40% of the original content has been reordered. So it's 100% kind of restructured with 60% new. And we'll see. I think this time I nailed it, but we'll only know when people start deploying the system again.
In the first edition, you had an exercise whereby a reader or a student would get 6 post-it notes or 6 notes.
Right, that's right.
And document their key activities. Did you change that exercise?
I did. So it was a process of deduction where all the things that could be this key activity you do, now rewind it. So what I did is I flipped it to start off with, what is your promise statement? What is your commitment to your customers? What do you intend to be known for? So instead of trying to reverse it and saying, this is what we want to be known for, start off by saying, what are you staking your reputation on? So the hopefully simplified approach is we want to be known for the fastest response. Or one example I use in the book is FedEx. FedEx wants to be known for delivering packages on time. That's what they stake your reputation on. Then we simply ask, of all the things we do, what most ensures that promise? What's the one thing that most ensures that promise? There's many things that contribute to, but what's the most important? So FedEx has customer service. FedEx has a logistics department. FedEx has print shops. They bought Kinko's. And of all those things, what most delivers on their promise of delivering packages on time is logistics, the management of moving packages. Therefore, that's this QBR. And one way to look at this is, imagine FedEx or any of our companies makes a shift. FedEx says, you know what? We're going to ditch logistics. We're going to go all in on customer service. Everyone in that department, logistics, is moving to customer service. Well, the headlines will come out probably a week or two from now saying, packages lost. You know, FedEx not delivering a single package, but they're super friendly about it. Like, fine, but they're going to go out of business. That they're known for delivering packages on time, and they're failing to do that core competency. Now, if I flip it, if FedEx says, you know what, screw customer service, we're canceling the department, we're going to go double down on logistics, what would be the impact? The headline 2 weeks from now says, you know, FedEx not answering the phones, but every package delivered on time. They may be hurt or injured, but they're not compromised. That company is going to continue to move forward. This is a multi-billion dollar corporation. If one thing that matters the most, that's the definition of most, there can only be one. So in our business, start off with what you want to be known for, and then figure out of all activities, what one activity most delivers on that. The one thing that can never be compromised, and that's your QBR.
Makes sense. That makes sense, Mike. So a lot of nonfiction authors who are succeeding have done what you've done, which is built a business around their book. So I'm curious, what would you see as your QBR role?
Oh, great. Yeah. So I actually talk about my own in my own book. It is writing books. So let me go through the process. The promise I make to my community is to simplify entrepreneurship. Now, I have a purpose, which is different than a promise. My purpose, the reason I do what I do, the greater why, as Simon Sinek would say, is to eradicate entrepreneurial poverty. That's what I feel called to do and why I'm building this organization. But the promise of how I eradicate entrepreneurial poverty, the thing that really matters to my customers is I'm going to take a complex subject, entrepreneurship, simplify it. So I simplify entrepreneurship. That's my promise. That's what I want to be known for. This guy made entrepreneurship easier for me or simpler for me. Then I ask, of all the things I do, which one delivers on that promise? Well, I do speaking engagements, we talked about. I write books. I do podcast interviews like we're doing now. I do all this stuff to promote the concepts. Of all those activities, which one do I stake my reputation most on? And it's not speaking, it's not podcast. I could screw this podcast horribly, and that may hurt me in the community that you're serving, but I think I'd continue on if my books serve at a high level. But conversely, if I said, you know what, screw my books, I'm just going to double down on podcasts. I'm really going to nail my presentation skills. Now, I may be able to present well, and maybe I can nail a podcast, but I won't have anything to back it. If my books are crap, who would want to follow this author guy? So writing books is everything. In fact, even including today, my team knows the most important activity is I produce extraordinary books, which means we have to devote an extraordinary amount of time for it. So I have a team here kind of blocking and tackling, and we're saying, let's make sure we're writing extraordinary books. And that's my QBR.
Do you spend long every day working on your books, or do you pick it?
Yeah, so I have a team working on the QBR, so I'm not alone. I have a co-writer, her name's AJ, but I have what's called in-season, off-season. So off-season, I spend at least an hour every day writing, usually from 6 to 7 in the morning, sometimes even earlier, 5:30. That's core competency. And I'm just writing, honestly, mostly for the garbage can. Just writing stories, ideas, collecting, and accumulating around other books I'm working. When I'm in season, I'm in contract with my publisher and have a deadline like I do right now. End of September is my next deadline. I write at least 4 hours a day, sometimes five. Beyond that, it's actually too grueling, if you will, for me.
Yeah, four or five is a lot.
Yeah, it's hard to get beyond that. I can do maybe 3,000 to 4,000 words in 4 to 5 hours, and not good words. They're kind of chunky. I'm not a speed writer, but I'm vomiting out ideas and thoughts. And then there's a lot of rewriting too. So as the book moves along, I'll use those blocks of 4 hours to look at what I've written and really start to boil it down to the essence of my ideas.
So are you editing within the same 4-hour session, or do you edit the previous day's work on the next day?
Oh, no, yeah, no, previous day's work. Yeah, it's either a full write day or a full edit day. It's hard for me to oscillate between the two. Sometimes I do, but it's hard.
And you mentioned before that you spend a lot of time working with your students and clients and helping that improve your books. How do you capture notes and research and ideas from all of those interviews? And
So I used to use Evernote. I moved over to OneNote just because it's the Microsoft product. I think Microsoft Word is still, at least for me, the de facto writing platform. So I want something that's a little more homogenous with that. But OneNote is where I'm collecting stuff. And I always have my phone on me. I had carried a notepad for a while, but I found the phone to be easier. So I'm recording voice notes, video notes, articles I read, and I just compiled in there. So how I sort this is I have right now about 30 to 35 topics, potentially book ideas I want to write on. And I just start putting ideas in there. Whenever I see something, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I look, does it fit into anything I'm accumulating? And I put it in there. When I'm deep into a book, so my next book is on recruiting employees and retaining employees, like really the top performers. How do you recruit and retain top performing people? Once I know that's the subject I'm going to start working on, then I go out and actively seek it. So in the off season, I'm passively seeking it. In the on season, I'm actively seeking it. And usually I'll have 100 to 200 notes or ideas in a subject, and then I'm like, okay, now it's time that I can write this.
I remember you also said a couple of years ago you wanted to write one book a year. Is that something that you're still trying to do?
Still trying to do. It's really one every 18 months is what I'm pacing at. So I do have one coming out, you know, Clockwork Revised and Expanded comes out in 2022. In 2023, I have a new book. The working title is All In, about these employees. And 2024, maybe a year I don't do something, but back by 2025.
Oh, wow. Good to see you've mapped it out for the next 2-3 years.
Yeah. I have the ideas. You know, part of it is I have ideas what I want to do. I've been with my publisher for a long time now and may stay with them. Maybe I'll go on my own. I don't think so. But they have an agenda too of things that they want. So sometimes I have an idea and they're like, oh, this is not good timing for us, or just something we don't want. So that's why it's hard to see really far down the road, but I can definitely see the next 2 to 3 years max.
And what do you find is the best format for your books? And the reason I ask is generally audio books of nonfiction tend to sell quite well versus Kindle.
Yeah. So on volume of sales, my nonfiction book sells, I'm sorry, the audiobook sells about 55% of my cumulative sales, maybe even 60 now. Print, I don't have any soft cover books out. I only print in hardcover. That's not my choice. This is my publisher. Generally, when a book sells strongly enough in hardcover, they don't cut to soft cover. There's a different perception, at least that's what I hear, from the consumer, that soft cover is the kind of economic choice. Even though printing and all that stuff sounds like it's basically the same. But nonetheless, my print books, so the hardcover books, probably represent 25 to maybe 30% sales. So, and then the remainder, Kindle, is maybe 15%. I don't know if those numbers are exactly right, but the majority is audio. Here's the interesting thing though. My audios, I read my own audiobooks. I encourage every author, always read your own book. Well, maybe if you're in fiction, that's not necessarily true, but in nonfiction, read your own book because you know how to emphasize it, stuff. I will riff in my books. I'll read my book and then I'll take a break from reading it and just tell a story. And what I found is that engages readers in a new way. And some of those folks decide to buy a print book and now they're looking in parallel. The audio readers feel they get a bonus material because they're getting a riff or some other.
Oh, so you're going off script slightly on.
We're going off script, yeah. Yeah, and they're like, oh, this is bonus material or it's different or whatever. And then they're using the book almost as a workbook to highlight what they're hearing. So that riffing has been a good tool to further engage people. And also seems to inspire some folks to get the print book too.
Yeah, Gary Vee does that as well in his audiobooks.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, he's the best at it. Yeah.
Yeah, I narrated an audiobook early last year. It was quite a demanding, tiring experience. Like I found I could only narrate several chapters before my voice would start to break.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's so funny. I just finished reading Clockwork. Usually you got to finish the audiobook a month before it gets published, but they want the manuscript totally tight. So there's this kind of tight window. This one got delayed a little bit, but my assistant scheduled me for 5-hour blocks for over 3 or 4 days. I'm like, my voice is going to fade. Like, and it's going to be choppy and ugly. And it's hard for me to read. So the second I arrived at the studio, I said, we got to book 3 or 4 more days. They're like, you sure? I said, I know my reading style. And sure enough, if I can get 2.5-3 hours of reading in per day out loud, that's pretty strong for me.
Mm. Yeah, that's quite a lot. And you also wrote a children's book during the lockdown, during the pandemic. Is that right?
I did. It's called My Money Bunnies. And what inspired that was twofold. I know another author who wrote a children's book. His name's Todd Herman. He wrote a book called The Alter Ego Effect. And he wrote a children's book to serve kids with the same method, was just explaining how they engaged his audience in a new way and how he was able to serve a new community. What I found, so that was the kind of the inspiration. Why I wrote the book, what I found with the book was, sure enough, you're engaging a new audience, kids and stuff. I actually just yesterday got an email from a reader who set up the jars I teach in the system with their daughter. And it was like a really cool story they shared. But the other kind of surreptitious technique that's happening here is I realized if I could write a book for children that the parents, because it's for very young children, would be reading the book to their kids or at least with their kids, which also meant if they're the ones teaching it, they're the ones who have to learn it. So it was kind of a backdoor way for me to teach parents profit first.
It's a good approach. I like that.
Yeah, it seems to be working. So we'll see.
And did it take as long to write as your other books?
No. Yeah, I remember someone saying like shorter books are harder to write. Yeah. But I don't know. I only have one experience with this. I had a perspective. I took the profit first principles that I learned and condensed it. So maybe that was a big leap off point or starting point. But for me, it was much easier to write. Listen, the cumulative book has maybe 300 words total. It's just a short children's book. It's the pictorial components that were hard. Working with the illustrator, ensuring that the graphics matched the vision. That was actually the harder part. So all said and done, it was still a 6 to 8 month project, but the writing time, you know, was substantially less for me.
Yeah. I interviewed a children's book author a few years ago. He said something similar, that it was the illustrations that took up the most time rather than the actual story itself.
Yeah, I was surprised. You know, I was surprised. Like, I thought I just laid out the vision as a young girl, but also I wanted her to be representative of what I was familiar with. A girl wasn't dressed in a Barbie-like costume playing with Barbie dolls. The girls I knew back in school were riding skateboards with the boys. Like, you know, we're all just hanging out together. So I wanted that character, because to me, that represented at least a real girl for me. Now, there's all different flavors, of course, but like that was more representative of it. And this artist kept coming back with these prototypical kind of Disney characters. I'm like, no, it's not what we want. And finally, we had a breakthrough there, and the illustrator saw it, I saw it, and then we had our character.
Makes sense. So one section that struck with me in Clockwork was the idea of taking a kind of a sabbatical. I think it was 4 weeks is what you advocated for. Is it still something similar? Is that still a recommendation you have for small business owners?
Yeah. And actually, I opened the book with the importance of that. The opening story is about that. That has been perhaps the most significant impact, is coming to this 4 week vacation. So I'll give you the philosophy behind it, and I'll give you the new discovery we had too.
Please.
Yeah. So the philosophy is, I've studied now hundreds of businesses intimately on the subject, thousands subjectively from a distance. What I've noticed is every business I studied goes through monthly cycles. We acquire new clients, we deliver our service or product, we may hire contractors or employees, maybe remove someone from the team. With the invoice and bill, we close out the month. Most businesses run on these monthly cycles. And that's when I realized, wow, if everything's happening within a month's time period, the owner or the leader of the company wasn't available for that month, that means the business has to address all of its different elements without the owner. Therefore, if we could leave the business for 4 weeks, live the business into perpetuity. So that became the 4 week trial, staying removed from your business for 4 consecutive weeks and seeing how the business does. Now, people are terrified to do this because they haven't prepared the business. And what I argue in the book is, it's not a question if you're going to take a 4 week vacation, it's simply a question of when you're going to take a 4 week vacation. Maybe thrust upon you through illness or some kind of unexpected situation that you have to address, but it is going to happen. You're not going to be there forever for every day. So that was the impetus behind this, and causing an intentional disruption so the business can get stronger in your absence, building the systems and structures. What we added in this new book was, the president of our company, I live by one great thing about being an author of a concept is, you got to live by the concept. So I'm taking my 4 week vacations. I get a call from the president of our company saying, we all need to take a 4 week vacation, every single employee here, because what's happening is, when the boss, when I'm away, the burden gets spread out to the rest of the team. But now we have dependency on the rest of the team. And what if one of those people leave or quit? So starting, I think it was 2 years ago, every employee here gets a full 4 week vacation, must be consecutive, paid by the company. And people are like, wow, this is a great recruiting tool. This is an amazing benefit. And it is. But the biggest benefit is to the company, because now it forces redundancy. Other people have to be able to cover for that person in their absence, or we have to get other mechanisms in place. And it's built a very nimble, strong company. So that's the new thing I introduced in Clockwork, is this concept of 4 week vacation for everybody. Not at the same time, just so you have constant intentional disruption. It's like building a muscle. You have to have that resistance to build muscle. You must have disruption in order to prepare for the inevitable disruptions that are going to happen.
Yeah, I took 17 days off, but I think I got to day 6 before I had to check in and pay some invoices and respond.
Well, there you go. And I challenge you, schedule another 4 week vacation. But day 6 is a very revealing day. Why did you have to do invoices? What systems can we put in place so that doesn't have to happen again? When we remove ourselves, it reveals the problems in the business and we step forward. I don't expect people to have a perfect 4 week vacation on their first departure. And even in the book, I tell people how to build up. Start with a 2-weeker like you were doing and build your way there. But every time something doesn't work, that's not a call for us to reinsert ourselves. That's a call for us to build a system to resolve that.
Mm, Makes sense. For your future books, do you have other concepts that you're kind of tinkering on in the background that you're trying to validate?
Yeah. So I'm working on one around partnerships. So one thing that's interesting in a lot of businesses, day one, I'm going to start a company. I feel I want to have a partner. I find a partner. There is a brief courting period, like, we've got this. It's going to be amazing. And the first 6 months or year is amazing because everyone's all in. It's after that, then there becomes this kind of conflict that can set in, or worse. And each partner feels they're shortchanged in some capacity by the other partner. And partnerships can fracture very quickly. And it seems to happen more often than not. So how do you make a partnership that lasts the distance of the business, that's supportive, that's successful? So I'm working on that. Selling a company has come up regularly, how to do the exit the right way. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs build a business and say, one day I'm going to sell this thing, and they are not prepared to sell it. And that one day comes and no one wants it. Well, that's a shame. That's a lot of money and opportunity left on the table. I'm thinking about that. A book on selling. What really is effective selling? How can someone that doesn't like to be a salesperson sell better than anyone else? So those are all things I have hypotheses on that we're playing with and tinkering and testing out. And maybe one of those books will be the next book in line for 2024, 2025.
Those are all big ideas. Do you still build a single business around each book, or are some of the books part of one business?
Each book has a licensee. So instead of me running the company, which is not, that's not my competency. I'm not great at that. Instead, what I do is I find partners and we partner up, and they roll out a company that provides a service behind it. What's interesting is when someone reads a book, you know, nonfiction book, a portion want to make sure they're doing it right and they hire the service behind it. So I think it's important to have the service. I just don't want to build each one of these businesses on my own. So for this new book, tentatively titled All In, we're going to have a partner who's already actively been testing and rolling out concepts. And then when the book launches, we're in full out mode of promoting those services.
So Mike, where should people go if they want to read any of your work? Where's the best place?
Best place to go? Well, you could go to mikemikalowicz.com. It's so hard to spell or pronounce. I got a website, mikemotorbike.com. I think I told you this before. I got it maybe 4 or 5 years ago. That was a nickname I had in grade school. It was the only like G-rated nickname. The other ones are too profane. So if you go to mikemotorbike.com, actually you'll see all my books listed up there. You can get chapter downloads from them to start experiencing those books right away. I used to write for the Wall Street Journal too. You'll see that there. That's mikemotorbike.com.
Yeah, I'm looking at it here. It is a fantastic animation, which I won't spoil.
Oh, yeah. Right. I love doing those Easter eggs. Right. When you land there, there's an animation. If you navigate the site, you'll find some crazy stuff that you won't find elsewhere. That's just a fun thing I like to do.
It was great, Mike. I'll put the links in the show notes. Thanks again for coming back on the show.
This has been a joy. Thanks for having me, Brian.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you did, please consider leaving a short review on the iTunes store or sharing the show on Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. More reviews, more ratings, and more shares will help more people find the Become a Writer Today podcast. And did you know, for just a couple of dollars a month, you could become a Patreon for the show? Visit patreon.com/becomeawritertoday or look for the support button in the show notes. Your support will help me record, produce, and publish more episodes each month. And if you become a Patreon, I'll give you my writing books, discounts on writing software, and on my writing courses.